Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Thursday, August 11th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by U.S. correspondent Jacob Magid and religions and diaspora affairs writer Judah Ari Gross. Hello to you both.
Hey, Jessica.
Hey, Jessica.
So what are we going to talk about today? We're looking at Egypt's envoys' severe criticism of Israel at the UN Security Council, as well as what ended up happening at the Western Wall on the 9th of Av. A final decision not to downgrade the U.S. military post rank that handles coordination between Israel and the PA. And what is the latest brouhaha at the Jewish agency, this time with regards to the Russian government? That's a lot of subjects to deal with. Jacob, we're going to get started with you. And what happened at the UN Security Council? Egypt seemed to save the day, brokering a ceasefire, then lashes out at Israel at the UN. Was there some underlying message here that you're going to tell us about?
Yeah, I just thought it was pretty surprising. I cover these monthly Security Council sessions where they just kind of regurgitate the same messages, all the different parties. The U.S. states its position, Israel attacks the Palestinians, Palestinians attack Israel. Nothing very interesting. This was an emergency meeting that they held because of the Gaza conflict. It was scheduled before while it was still going on, so we could have just not had it, but they decided to move forward with it. And they decided to also invite Egypt, which is not a member of the Security Council currently, but because of their role in mediating the ceasefire, I guess they wanted to give them an opportunity to share their thoughts on what had happened. And the Egyptian ambassador, Osama Abdel Khalik, just went off on Israel in his about, I don't know, 5-10 minute speech. And it wouldn't have been that noteworthy. Oftentimes, foreign affairs ministries seem to take a bit of a harder line on Israel than maybe their governments themselves that are more interested in improving relations, like President Sisi is in Egypt. But clearly, that message didn't get through to the foreign ministry. And even though Israel, in the hours right after, during the conflict, right after the conflict, even in Gilad Erdan, the UN ambassador's, Israeli ambassador to the UN speech, all three of those times thanked Egypt and thanked Sisi and thanked Egyptian officials for their help. And that did not change at all the Egyptian ambassador's tone toward Israel in this speech. Basically started off by lamenting the martyrs that were killed, the 43 martyrs. 43 was not the number that were killed. It was 46 at that time. Now it's 47. But that number was off. He called them all martyrs and didn't distinguish between different PIJ fighters, Palestinian Islamic Jihad fighters, and innocent civilians. And then went on to berate Israel over allowing settlers under the protection of the Israeli police to incur the courtyards of the Haram al-Sharif. So he didn't really like the idea that there were Jewish visitors at the Temple Mount on Tisha B'Av, which took place also in the middle of the conflict. And then went further to say that Israel, while Egypt is happy to continue into mediating, but Israel is fully responsible for the occupied Gaza Strip, in his words, which was kind of interesting. And then when he went further to say that Israel needs to end its blockade of Gaza, not, I guess, ignoring the irony of the fact that Egypt has its own blockade over the Strip, but that didn't get any mention, neither did any mention of the Islamic Jihad at all. And he ended the speech by saying Egypt will never abandon its historical responsibilities to the Palestinian brotherly people. So it was quite a fiery speech. Maybe, again, Egypt is in this unique position where it's similar to Jordan, where it kind of tries to straddle both lines, where it often will tell Israeli officials behind closed doors, look, we're only saying these things publicly to appease our publics who don't want to see us really cozying up to Israel too much. But this is still coming on the backdrop of really warmed relations over the past few years between Israel and Egypt, particularly since the Netanyahu government, where Yair Lapid is visited when he was foreign minister, and Egypt made a point of having an Israeli flag behind him at the time, which wasn't happening during the Netanyahu years. So things are changing at the presidential level in Egypt, but clearly they haven't trickled down to the foreign ministry, or they're just giving them a directive to continue this line of attack on Israel in one room, and then another room being willing to speak more kindly.
So any fallout from the vitriol, from the criticism at this point?
Yeah, so I asked the Erdogan's office to see if they wanted to respond, because they're very quick to call out various officials when they criticize Israel. When Tora Wennesland, the UN envoy for the Middle East peace process, expressed his deep concern over the killing of the PIJ senior commander that kind of sparked the conflict on Friday, Erdogan took minutes to respond to the UN envoy and trashed him publicly and said, how dare you try to draw an equivalency between Israel and the PIJ? And then when Egypt does the same thing, I guess Erdogan's clearly getting directions from above, possibly that we don't want to pick a fight right now with Egypt, and Israel's trying to not get dragged in that direction right now. So that's kind of interesting.
All right. So I guess we'll see if there's any effect of this as we move forward.
Yeah.
Judah, speaking of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, nerves were very high prior to the 9th of Av fast that took place on Saturday night, Sunday, ahead of the egalitarian reading of Lamentations at the Western Wall on Saturday night. But nothing actually seemed to happen, despite what's been happening over the last few weeks. Why? Where? Fill us in.
Yeah, so to start talking about this, we sort of have to go to last year's 9th of Av, or Tisha B'Av, which is a day of mourning in the Jewish calendar, marking the destruction of the two Jewish temples and a number of other catastrophes that have befallen the Jewish people on that date. So last year at the egalitarian section of the Western Wall, a group of, you know, Orthodox extremists broke into the site and set up gender-segregating barriers, or mechitzas, and disrupted the prayer service that was taking place there. It was sort of denounced. Nothing really happened on the ground practically in terms of government decisions on the matter. It just was an unfortunate event, is sort of how it was treated. And then fast forward to about a month and a half ago, there was another event at the egalitarian section of the Western Wall where another group, you know, not the same group, but another sort of related group of Orthodox extremists broke into the section on the first day of the Hebrew month of Tammuz and interrupted a bunch of bar and bat mitzvahs that were taking place there. They called the people there Nazis. They ripped up prayer books. And that resonated not very much in Israel, but it resonated very heavily in the United States because those bar and bat mitzvahs were overwhelmingly American families. That sparked some serious criticism from a number of American and international Jewish organizations, most significantly the Jewish Agency. So that's sort of the context that this is happening in. There were real concerns that there was going to be a repeat performance of this disruption. And there were some calls initially by some far-right Orthodox organizations to go and to protest. And in the end, sort of on Saturday night, it was a very subdued, melancholy affair, the way that it normally is, you know, that in matching the atmosphere of a day of mourning. The book was read, there were no disruptions, it sort of came and went. And there's a few different reasons why that happened. I think one is this was all happening while the fighting in Gaza was still going, you know, full force. And I think I know that there's a good number of people, conservative, reform people, who didn't come because of that. Also, a number of people didn't come to Jerusalem at all because of that, just because they didn't want to be traveling on Saturday night. They wanted to be close to home, close to a bomb shelter. So there was a good amount of people just staying home and not coming out. In general, the Western Wall on Tisha B'Av is sort of a mob scene. There's lots and lots of people there. There were far fewer this year, previous years. Also, I think there was a general understanding among some of the sort of more radical Orthodox groups that this had a bit of a boomerang effect. And if they want to prevent the acceptance of non-Orthodox egalitarian prayer at the Western Wall, this kind of disruption is going to have the opposite effect.
Okay, thanks for that, Judah. We're going to take a quick break. And when we're back, Jacob will talk about the ongoing plan of lowering the rank for U.S. security coordinator in Israel.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag in a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jewish Quarterly is the leading international journal of ideas and culture. In the August issue, Kim Gattis investigates Iran's 43-year quest to dominate the Middle East. Aryeh Dubnov casts light on Israel's first native Hebrew speaker. William Miles reports on the Jews of the West Indies, plus features on the Ukraine pogroms, the Sassoon dynasty, and Hannah Arendt. Jewish Quarterly, out now at good booksellers worldwide or subscribe at jewishquarterly.com.
And we're back. So, Jacob, you have written more than once about this back and forth on the plan to lower the rank required to for the appointment of the U.S. Security Coordinator, the USSC, in Jerusalem from a 3-star general to a colonel. But now it seems it was going to happen, but it's not happening.
Yeah, the first time I heard about this, it felt very inside baseball to me and still does, and didn't feel like it really had a big deal behind it. But I think it was interesting seeing the backlash from various members of Congress from both parties, almost about 100 of them, who spoke out about this plan. Basically, what happened was in 2017, Congress passed legislation that sought to save some money and cut costs by lowering the ranks of over 100, I believe 111 positions across the globe where military officials are stationed, from the ranks of 3-star general to a colonel. The Pentagon accepted this plan because, I mean, they were mandated to do so. And among those positions that they were planning to downgrade was the one in Jerusalem, the U.S. Security Coordinator there. And this immediately sparked backlash basically from this one small think tank policy group in the U.S. called the Israel Policy Forum, which really made this issue its baby and lobbied Congress pretty heavily to try to get involved and reverse the plan, because they argue that this this lowering of the rank will damage efforts by the U.S. to coordinate between Israel and the Palestinians on the ground. This position was essential. It came up very recently with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. The current commander, Mike Fenzel, was involved in convincing the Palestinians to hand over the bullet to the Biden administration to do its own ballistic analysis and then come up with this findings that they couldn't decide who killed her. But it was still, the position's clearly important, and there's concern in the Israel Policy Forum and then the members of Congress on both party and both sides of the aisle that they managed to convince that if you downgrade this position, you'll damage U.S. efforts in the region. But when I reached out just a week ago to the Pentagon to ask if their plan was still to downgrade the post, they told me, "Yep, that's our plan." I don't know why everyone's so surprised. Congress is the one that asked us to do this, and it's ironic that a majority of the members that are now writing to us begging us not to downgrade the post were the same ones that backed the 2017 legislation asking us to cut spending because it costs more money to have higher ranking generals in the field. So that was that was then. But then about yesterday, I got a tip that actually this is not the case. And I was able to follow up and confirm with a couple of congressional offices who were notified by the Pentagon that actually they were going to be walking back their plan to downgrade the post in Jerusalem, and it will remain at the level of a 3-star general, which even the Biden administration, Secretary Blinken, and U.S. Ambassador to Israel Tom Nides have been lobbying for. So clearly, I think the pressure from both members of Congress, both parties in Congress, the administration itself, led to them walking back this step that they were hoping to try to save some money. I guess they'll have to find other offices to downgrade instead.
Surprising, though. And just give us a quick word about the moderate rival that nearly upset squad member Ilhan Omar in the primary race, in which pro-Israel groups sat out this race. So give us a little bit of an update about that, because obviously we've been following her career since the start.
Right. So Ilhan Omar is a two-term congresswoman and now I guess a three-term congresswoman, but she was expected to win in a landslide on Tuesday in the primary. There wasn't much polling, but one showed her up by 40% in June. So I myself interviewed Don Samuels, her challenger, a centrist who describes himself as pro-Israel, but pro-two-state solution, and thinks Omar is an extremist who's alienated a lot of people. And he argued that actually it was going to be a close race. But when I interviewed him, there was a lot going on at the time, and I never really got a chance to write it up right then and there. And it took me until the day before to finally get the interview published, the day before the primary. But even then, nobody really covered this guy, or really endorsed him either. It was interesting. The last election in 2018, Ilhan Omar's challenger received millions of dollars from various pro-Israel organizations who tried to unseat Omar, who's very pro-Palestinian legislator, one of the few who now supports the BDS movement. So clearly a target or a logical target for these pro-Israel groups, but they decided in this race to sit it out. They felt that they spent all this money last time and didn't really go anywhere. Ilhan Omar won by roughly 20 points at that point. So they decided to focus on other races. And this year they've been quite successful in unseating or defeating progressive candidates with more moderate traditionally pro-Israel options. So it was quite surprising to see in the end that Ilhan Omar only won 50% to 48%. So, and just 2,500 votes between her and Don Samuels, which was a shock to, I guess, people who weren't following. Maybe those who are listening to Don Samuels who said, really, there are a lot of people that she's alienated and that this is going to be a closer race than people think. I guess we should have listened to him. Ultimately, Omar was able to pull off the victory, but you got to be wondering whether it had there been this influence of the pro-Israel super PACs that have been really getting involved in swaying different races, maybe this race could have gone a different way.
Right. What would have happened in that situation? Okay. And finally, Judah, let's finish up with you. Tell us what's happening at the Jewish Agency and its latest struggles with the Russian government.
To catch us up a bit, Russia for the past month and a half has been actively seeking to shutter the Jewish Agency's operations in the country. Israel generally sees this as a diplomatic move. Israeli officials generally believe, Israeli officials and Jewish agency officials sort of see this as a way that Russia is putting pressure on Israel, on Prime Minister Yair Lapid specifically. Russia denies this and says it's purely a legal issue. In the meantime, though, there's been a lot of diplomatic efforts to try to resolve this, to negotiate some kind of understanding, to allow the Jewish agency, which sort of does all these things that are related to Jewish immigration to Israel or Aliyah, to make sure that the organization can sort of keep doing what it's doing so that Russian Jews can continue to make Aliyah move to Israel. So there are sort of, on the one hand, there are the leading legal proceedings that are going on, and then there's also a number of diplomatic efforts. Earlier this week, President Isaac Herzog called, Russian leader Vladimir Putin to discuss the matter specifically. And they agreed to sort of continue discussing the issue. And then sort of separately from these efforts that are going on to, save the Jewish agency's operations in Russia, the Jewish agency is preparing for the possibility that they won't be saved and they're going to have to close their offices in Russia and then still figure out a way to help the Russian Jews that are there that are going to want to, some of whom are going to want to move to Israel. So those discussions are happening now. The Jewish agency does not necessarily believe that, its closure is imminent. There is still hope that some sort of negotiated settlement will be reached. There'll be some compromise. Maybe they have to scale back some of their activities. They have to change some of their activities. But they're not going to, they hope that they're not going to have to sort of completely close up shop.
Yeah, so it feels a little bit like 1972.
That's absolutely the feeling that a lot of people have. It's very concerning. There's obviously a deep history of Jews in Russia being stuck behind, you know, the Iron Curtain, not being able to immigrate to Israel, not being able to practice their religion freely. I mean, these are issues that are, you know, even if it's, you know, even if the situation is somewhat different today, obviously this evokes a lot of those memories. And so that's something that's still very much sort of in the air. But the Jewish Agency for now is sort of trying to figure out, does that mean doing more things online or doing things under new organizations that don't have the same legal issues as they do currently, or, you know, stepping up operations in neighboring countries so that Russians can go there to do whatever they have to do. You know, those are the kinds of things that now the Jewish Agency is working out so that it can make sure that it's able to continue operating, you know, to some extent, you know, maybe not at its fullest, but to some extent for Russian Jews going forward.
Okay, so we'll keep on following that, obviously, as we go on. In the meantime, Judah, thank you for being on today's Daily Briefing. And thank you, Jacob, for being on today's Daily Briefing.
Thank you.
And listeners, we'll be back on Sunday. In the meantime, take a listen on Friday to this week's Times Will Tell. Take care and happy listening.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.